Welcome to this episode of the Normalized Surrogacy Podcast by Surrogacy Mentor. I'm your host, Carrie Flamer Powell, experienced gestational surrogate, former surrogacy agency owner, and founder of Surrogacy Mentor, where our aim is to help surrogates match with reputable surrogacy agencies for a safe, ethical, and enjoyable surrogacy journey. Marielle Schuberth, surrogate intake coordinator for Surrogacy Mentor, is not with us today, but I do have a very special guest. Today, we are discussing the legal side of surrogacy with attorney and surrogacy agency owner, Steve Snyder. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Carrie. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be able to educate. I started out my life as a high school teacher, so I know how important that process is in every aspect of life, but most importantly in the surrogacy process.
Definitely. Yeah, so happy to have you. So let me just give a little background on Steve and what he does in the surrogacy world, which is a lot. So just a bit, Steve Snyder, a practicing attorney since 1982. I won't tell you how old I was, but I was definitely not old enough to be a practicing attorney at 1982. So I don't know if that makes you feel good or not.
Well, it makes me feel, shall we say, wise.
Okay, yes, wise. We'll go with that. Practicing attorney since 1982 is nationally known for his work helping families with assisted reproduction law. He's the past chair of the American Bar Association's Assisted Reproductive Technology Committee Family Law Section. Steve's also the executive director of IARC, which stands for International Assisted Reproduction Center, which is a surrogacy agency based in Minnesota with an impressive 30 plus year history. And I'm sure it's over 2,000 births by now for parents worldwide. Steve works daily to make surrogacy and other family building options available to as many aspiring parents around the world as possible. So that's just a little snippet actually of what you do and what you're involved in this surrogacy field. So I had to narrow it down a little, but you've been around a while in this industry and you have a lot to share with us. Yay. Let's dive right in. So you're the second attorney that I'm speaking with and not the last. And some of these questions might be similar for those that have listened to the previous legal process podcast episode. And that's intentional, right? Every attorney, dependent upon which area of law they practice and also which states they focus on, may have different perspectives and different experience. So some of these questions may be the same, some may be different. But let's just start with, in your opinion and your experience, what is the general overview of the legal process for a surrogacy journey from the parent and surrogate perspective? And do you work on one more than other?
I think that I represent far more intended parents than surrogates, but I represent a lot of surrogates as well. Okay. And standing on opposite sides of that same conversation truly enables me to see both sides much more clearly and advocate for the person that I'm representing. And that is the first key, is that each side must have adequate, experienced, knowledgeable legal representation, because surrogacy arrangements are a complex dovetailing of the interests and needs of the surrogate, who is autonomous and has self-control over her own body, and the parents who are entrusting her with their most precious gift, which is the child she is going to gestate. And to have two people who can balance that conversation, one for the surrogate, critical to have separate representation, one for the parents, to have the conversation so that everything is clearly understood. All of the details are made express so everybody knows what's going on, is the most critical part of a surrogacy journey and a positive, healthy relationship between the surrogate and the parents.
Okay, great. So let's say you have some parents who have just been matched with the surrogate and they now need a contract. So what does that process look like from your perspective? What goes into that process for someone who's literally never heard of gestational surrogacy and especially not the legal process?
The first important fundamental fact that surrogates should be aware of is that surrogacy is a part of parentage law in each state. And parentage law is uniquely a state law matter, which means there are 50 different laws governing what can and can't go in the contract and what the process will look like, especially at the end when you do the parentage proceeding. When the two parties start the process, the first issue is which law is going to govern. Because if the parents live in the United States, as many of them do, you can use the law of the state where the surrogate resides and gives birth, which is the most common choice, because that's the state that will govern the birth records and the processes. However, if the parents live in another state that perhaps has a faster or more efficient process, it's also possible to use the state law of the parents' residence. And that will be something the attorneys will advise their parties about, and they'll reach an agreement, which in the contract is called a choice of law. Another area that you could choose is where the embryo transfer takes place. California, for example, has a specific statute that says if the embryo transfer takes place here, you can take advantage of all our pre-birth rules and procedures. Understanding what the options are and knowing that you do have input into that is an important first step. Now, what your contract is going to look like is going to depend on the state law. For example, if you do a surrogacy in almost all states, save for Michigan, where it's still criminalized, or Louisiana, where it has to be the intended parent's gametes and you can't be compensated, or some other minor jurisdictions, surrogacy is viable, feasible, and reliable, but the procedures are all different. You may hear the phrase pre-birth state, which means when you get to the point of parentage, the court's going to issue an order during the pregnancy that's going to establish parentage immediately upon birth with the parents. You may hear the word post-birth state, which means the process for changing parentage has to be at the end. Those end points affect the contract, and they affect whether and how the financial terms are phrased in terms of states where compensation is allowed, and it's just referred to as that, or states where compensation isn't allowed, where it's referred to as reimbursement of expenses and other living items. So your attorney needs to be versed in the law of the state, the law of which is going to govern. And that means just because you may live in Iowa and your parents live in California, if California law is going to govern, you need a California attorney because they know the law that's going to govern the procedure. Even though you live in Iowa, you shouldn't have an Iowa attorney. So make sure that the legal representation that you find or the agency assists you in finding is well-versed in the law that's going to govern the contract. Then it's a function of talking to your agency, because much of what may go into the contract, depending on your agency, may be governed by some preliminary terms and conditions that they've had you assess and agree to so that they know which parents to match you with. And some of that should be carried forward into the contract. Some of it's going to be dictated by the opinion and experience of your attorney. So you need to make sure you have very open, candid conversations first with your agency and then with your attorney, and make sure that those are in alignment or at least understand their respective position and negotiating leverage. In terms of what goes into the contract, that's going to vary from attorney to attorney. The contract that I draft is 54 pages, single-spaced. You have to read that and understand it. And then you have to talk with your attorney about it, because many of the provisions are very legal language heavy, but they all matter to you. The important thing is that you, as a surrogate, have autonomy and you have power to make sure the agreement meets with your needs. And don't let an agency convince you to do something that is against your personal preferences without discussing it with them. Don't let an attorney tell you what to do unless what that attorney is telling you is in keeping with your intent and your preferences. You have power, and don't let it go in the process.
Okay, I like that. And just to play a little devil's advocate, even though I myself am an experienced surrogate, I also would say, having also been an agency owner, that while both sides have certain amounts of power in the legal process, there can definitely be lines that are crossed, which this is a good segue into the next question. There can be lines that are crossed and times where people might feel taken advantage of, or for lack of a better term, nickel and dimed for little things. And contracts can be the stressful part of the process. And that's probably an understatement, right? So what are some of the common sticking points that you see, whether just obstacles that are routinely able to be overcome during the legal process, or maybe even instances where you've seen entire matches fall apart because they just couldn't get over certain things during contracts?
It is impossible to predict, as between any two sets of parents and a surrogate, which things will become a sticking point. A very common one right now is vaccination for COVID, because there is clear evidence that pregnancies for the surrogate and the child are safer if the surrogate is vaccinated. And parents obviously want a healthy pregnancy, but surrogates have the autonomy to be vaccinated or not. So that is something that should be covered by your agency before even providing a match possibility, so that you are only being matched with parents that accept your personal position on that. Another kind of issue, and this evolves from the shared nature of the process: the surrogate's body, the parent's baby. I just had a contract where one of the sticking points was that the parents wanted control over the delivery. And the surrogate clearly has control over her own body during the delivery. So the attorneys will flesh that out and advise both parties. But even if the parties come to consensus, understand there will be issues in the pregnancy and delivery that affect only the child, not the surrogate. There will be other issues that directly affect the surrogate and her health and not the child. And there will be some that affect both. Okay. I had a surrogate that had a prior C-section, but she and the parents agreed that she'd do a VBAC because she wanted to deliver vaginally. And they were all in agreement. But during the delivery, the child was in distress and the physician said, I think we should do a C-section. And the surrogates, or the parents, wanted a C-section, but the physician and the surrogate said that having a VBAC was still possible. So in the middle of the delivery, we have a conflict over what's best for the child and what the surrogate wants. And there has to be a dispute resolution mechanism in the contract that helps you sort through that. Less than 1% of surrogacies have these kinds of issues, whether they're during pregnancy or during delivery. But having a very good surrogacy contract requires that you contemplate all possible outcomes and have these kinds of dispute resolution mechanisms in place. There have been cases where, after that agreement is reached, a surrogate has changed her mind, and then that can cause conflicts. An example I have from my own practice is I had a couple that very clearly just wanted a singleton pregnancy. They said, we're starting a business, we can't have more than one child. The surrogate agreed to selective reduction or control over termination. They put one embryo in because they only wanted one baby. And that darn embryo split into twins. And two perfectly healthy babies and the parents asked her to selectively reduce one healthy twin because they only wanted one baby. These are real life happenstances. You have to think about these in advance. You have to have a contract that is drafted so that if there's a disagreement, there is a resolution that's available.
Absolutely. And I like that we're talking about specific examples because it helps illuminate it for people that maybe aren't familiar with surrogacy or the contract process. And again, like you said, it's very rare for these sorts of things to happen. But what is it? Expect the best, plan for the worst is how to summarize contract process. And when I was an agency owner, we had a really rare one in a million situation where a surrogate transferred one embryo. It split into triplets. And as part of the triplets, two were conjoined twins. And so it was a super complex situation with lots of professionals involved, but selective reduction was ultimately decided upon. But that was something that wasn't contemplated in the contract because who would think that out of one embryo, you'd get three babies and two of those babies would be conjoined. So it was a really complicated scenario that thankfully ended well for all parties. But it's good for people to realize that when you're doing any kind of legal contract, the default position of the attorney is always going to be, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but having been part of thousands of contract processes, I can confidently say that the default is always going to be to plan for the worst case scenario in that contract. And though you may never see any of those things come to fruition or reality, at least it's in there.
And when I talk to surrogates about the abortion termination selective reduction provision, I always emphasize, and not all attorneys are as clear with surrogates. That's why you need an experienced, knowledgeable attorney to make sure they do bring your attention down to the granular details. But many surrogates will come into the process and say, oh, sure, I'll terminate if you ask me. But their assumption is that's never going to happen. So they agree to it, thinking it's not going to happen. And then when it happens and they're faced with it, the emotions don't encourage them to follow through with what they promise. So that language in particular is language that I slow down with every surrogate. And I say, this is a provision that has caused more conflicts over more contracts than anything else I've seen in my practice. Don't make this promise unless you can follow through with it. Don't assume it's not going to happen. Because if it does, it is the most critical decision that the parents and you have to make, and it is the most potential for conflict. The other kinds of things is contracts have a lot of behavioral limitations on the surrogate. And again, this is something that the surrogate can only give up if she freely consents. A simple thing, don't get any tattoos. Had a case where the parents friended the surrogate on Facebook, and 3 months into the pregnancy, she posted a picture of her new tattoo. And she said, I can't get a tattoo. And I said, it's in the contract. You need to read the contract.
And for people listening that, again, don't understand the process, the reason why you should not get a tattoo during a pregnancy is because you risk infection of serious things such as hepatitis C, or anything that can be transmitted with a needle, getting a tattoo, and then also infection during a pregnancy. Anytime you're carrying a pregnancy, any sort of infection is going to be more dangerous.
And then there are small things like many contracts say you can't drink more than 8 or 16 ounces of caffeine a day. If you're a caffeine addict, pay attention to that. You can't eat seafood. You can't do things that are dangerous to the pregnancy. And then I had a surrogate post a picture at 7 months of a pregnancy of her on a roller coaster. And you just, sometimes you read a contract in the most favorable light with the greatest expectations of nothing happening, and you don't think about how it's actually going to impact your life. And as a surrogate, one of the things a psychologist assess you for is compliance. One of the reasons they assess you for compliance is because once you start the surrogacy process, a lot of it is being told what to do, what you can do and what you can't do. So you are entering into a place where you are gifted the responsibility for a child that other people may have different values and expectations over. So all of the behavioral limitations are things you should pay specific attention to. And if you don't think you can follow through on them, you shouldn't have them in the contract. And that's a conversation you should have with your attorney.
Right. And this is a rudimentary way to explain it to people that maybe don't understand, but I always liken being a gestational surrogate to babysitting. Again, rudimentary, but in this context, it's like when you babysit a child for someone and they say, please don't feed them nuts, and please make sure they're in bed by 7, and please don't have your boyfriend over while you're babysitting my child. And I would appreciate it if you weren't like distracted by your phone while you're watching my 6-month-old baby or whatever. There are certain things that you're asked to do that keep that child safe and or comfortable according to what the parents feel safe and comfortable with. And it's not really any different. It's just much more involved and for a very long time period when you're a gestational surrogate. And so if you think about it like that, like obviously parents are going to have things that are important to them that they're going to ask of you.
Another kind of conversation that I have frequently is, when you are off work, you often get lost wages. And if the reason you're off work is due to the pregnancy, you will get lost wages, but you need a physician to give you a letter that directly ties the loss of work to the pregnancy. I just recently had a surrogate that said, well, if I just don't feel well and I can't go to work, isn't that enough? I know my body. And the reality is, if you sign a contract that requires an attending physician statement and you can't get that, you're not going to get lost wages. So understand how those procedures work as well. There are so many nuances of how you assert your rights and how those rights are balanced between you and the parents that it's just the highlighted or underscoring of the importance of separate legal counsel who is experienced, knowledgeable, and has your back.
Awesome. So let's segue a little bit into kind of a hot topic these days in not just surrogacy, but the country in general, which is the possible overturning of Roe versus Wade, the abortion rights in America, as well as several states that have written into law or are in the process of potentially passing laws in their state to limit and or completely get rid of abortion rights. So how does this affect surrogacy?
As I said, let's do abortion 101 and kind of reiterate some things maybe we've already implicitly said. But under the current law, a woman has a right to control her own pregnancy and body, subject to the trimester or progression of pregnancy rules that various statutes have. But in essence, abortions have generally been available throughout the United States. In the 1970s, before the decision in Roe v. Wade, some states allowed abortions and some states didn't. I live in Minnesota. You couldn't get an abortion without your parents' consent. In Wisconsin, anybody over 16 could get an abortion. So people drove from the Twin Cities to Madison and they got their abortions there because it was legal where they were going to do it. Mm-hmm. Just as there was a patchwork before Roe v. Wade of states that will and won't allow abortions, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, that's simply going to resurface. Now, Texas was the alarm that brought this issue to light. The Texas statute says if a physician commits an abortion, then there are civil damages, not less than $10,000, and anybody can bring a suit. But in the definitional provision of the statute, it said a physician was someone licensed in Texas. The reason it said that is because states can only regulate abortions within their borders. Mm-hmm. Texas can't say it's illegal to get an abortion in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So, no matter when, now before Roe is overturned or afterwards, it's always going to be up to the surrogate to follow through on whatever agreement she had, and she has the control to void that agreement based on her personal preference, even if she agreed to it in a contract. So it's really a good faith agreement between the parents and the surrogate. If the surrogate wants to follow through on that and she resides in Texas, it means she can't get an abortion in Texas, but she can leave the state and go elsewhere to a state which will allow the abortion. So in my humble opinion, unless and until every one of the 50 states passes a law that restricts or abolishes abortion, it's simply going to be a function of transience to another state with an eye toward the specific provisions of the law that could apply where you live. So again, this requires legal consult and analysis, because could states try to regulate extraterritorial abortions? Boy, I suppose some really rabid conservatives could. Maybe there'd be a statute that might. I don't think it'll be constitutional, but you shouldn't do anything until you've assessed your legal rights under the specific language of the statute that may apply. But I suspect this abortion issue is simply going to be a matter of crossing state lines going forward.
Yeah, and I don't know offhand which they were, but there was a state or two that were considering making it also criminal to leave the state to obtain an abortion. I want to say Texas was one where I heard that. But to back up just a little bit for people that are listening, I don't want to give the impression that abortion is something that's just used all of the time in surrogacy and that it happens frequently and that it's just laissez-faire, whatever. It's definitely something that's only a worst case scenario or a situation that's rare, hopefully, I think. And my experience has been rare that it has had to be utilized, but it's all, no one is wanting to terminate a healthy pregnancy for no good reason. These are situations that are heart-wrenching, that are often because the child will have no quality of life or low quality of life, and or there may be two babies and one baby may not make it if the pregnancy is allowed to continue. And there may also be a situation where the surrogate is in danger. We had one situation with a surrogate who had hyperemesis gravidarum, which is basically the worst possible nausea and morning sickness you can ever imagine, times 100. She was in the hospital, unable to eat, on a feeding tube, unable to even lift her head. And she was at the point where she could not go one more day pregnant. And thankfully, she did actually push through and had the baby, but it was certainly a situation where she felt like her life was ending. She was so sick. And so there are not like surrogates going and having abortions every day just because, not to scare anyone.
No, and understand women, the wonderful, giving, thoughtful women that want to be surrogates, the people that are listening to this podcast, do not go into the process to arbitrarily terminate a healthy pregnancy. I've never seen that happen in my entire career.
Never.
That's not the issue.
No.
The issue is if you as a surrogate are going to have an adverse health outcome that threatens your life, can you? Yes. Even if it's in the contract, it will be written so that you have that authority. Do not be afraid of that. That is not a conflict. That is protecting you. And the contracts are drafted to protect you. In terms of parents who, for various reasons, there was a baby in Connecticut that was missing like two critical organs, and the parents asked the surrogate to terminate. And that's a legitimate reason. Or if the child is diagnosed with spina bifida and it's going to have a very traumatic and painful few days of life, there are reasons when it's appropriate. Carrie referenced my 2,000 births or more. I've had two cases, two, in 30 years, thousands of cases, where parents have asked for an abortion, and both of them are well justified. So this is a big conversation because it's obvious and there isn't enforceability that's clear, but it's not something that is common. It's highly unlikely to affect your journey, and yet you must assume it will in making whatever agreements you make.
Absolutely. And also because it's such a common thing that we're dealing with in the news and in politics right now that is evolving and changing and shifting in major ways. It's something that, you know, we in the surrogacy professionals community are keeping our eye on really closely because it affects how we write those contracts and what the rights are and what the options are for everyone. I appreciate the example that in all of your thousands of births, you've only, or pregnancies, you've only had two. That's a pretty amazing statistic for people to keep in mind. So what have we not covered with regard to contracts that you think is critical for a surrogate or a parent to remember about the legal contract process for surrogates?
Be aware that at the end of the process, every surrogate says it's not my baby. Every parent says it is theirs. Don't be intimidated or worried if the legal process in the state where you reside or the law that is chosen requires a post-birth process where actually, according to the law of that state, it says you can't change parentage until there's actually a baby alive to change parentage over. It's logical. Mm-hmm. But your process and the timing of it is irrelevant to the intent of the parties or the ultimate parentage is going to be established. It's semantics, it's timing. There is really no difference in the outcome. So if somebody, I know everybody online talks about pre-birth processes, but if you are entering into a post-birth process, you are just as certain not to have responsibility for the child. You're just as certain that those parents are going to receive the child and happily take it home to love and raise. Don't be daunted by the difference in semantics. At the end of the day, the parents are still going to have sole control in the hospital after birth. You're still going to have control over your body until the birth, and the parentage proceeding is still going to occur, and you're going to be relieved of any parental responsibility. So semantics doesn't matter.
But what does matter is having, as you mentioned, an experienced attorney who's well-versed in surrogacy specific to the state where the parentage will be determined, and someone who's got enough experience that they can really give you a great perspective on what things are important. So if you have a cousin that does Social Security law, or an aunt or a friend of an aunt who does family law in general, this is not the time to work with them. You need to lean on your agency to help you find a suitably experienced attorney in surrogacy.
One of the disputes in surrogacy was a California surrogate in a pre-birth state that got pregnant with triplets for a single deaf postman who lived in his parents' basement. And yes, he said, I can't raise three babies. I want you to selectively reduce. And she reneged. Mm-hmm. And as the facts came out, she was a second-time surrogate. She'd been through the process before. Mm-hmm. She'd signed a contract before. But when she went through the contract for this particular surrogacy, her attorney essentially said, you've been through the process before. Do you have any questions? And she said, no. And the attorney took that as her having independent counsel. Yeah. I don't care how many times you choose to give this gift or how many contracts you may enter into. They may be under different state law. Don't accept an attorney's offer of, did you read the contract? Yep. Do you understand it? Yep. Do you have any questions? Nope. Okay, we're done. Every time you do it, because of the potential variability of the terms and the importance to your happy outcome, make sure your attorney goes paragraph by paragraph and page by page and highlights everything so that you are refocused on it and have a new willingness to agree to those terms. So all of us are here to protect you. And that starts with you thoughtfully engaging with your attorney and, yes, reading the contract. And one of the other things I often ask in parentage proceedings when I have a married surrogate is I say, so did you read the contract? And she says, yes. And then when I have to talk to the husband, I said, did you read the contract? And he goes, nothing. No. And I go, so your wife read it and then told you it was okay and you just accepted it because you never read it. And he said, yeah, make sure if you're married, your spouse reads it too, because there are provisions in there that bind him too. Like he can't have sex with you for a while. He's got to be okay with that.
Right. Him or her. So I had a wife. Yeah. I was a surrogate and my wife was bound to some of those, not exactly. The sex. Yeah, that was, but she, yeah, there were some certain things that she, that were important for her as well. So yeah, if you have a spouse, then they need to read it as well. Agreed.
Yeah.
This has been super educational and enlightening. And I just so appreciate your time and your knowledge, which is vast, sharing that with us. And I look forward to hearing more about what you're doing out in the surrogacy world. I'm sure I will see many wonderful things from you. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me on, Carrie. Hopefully the information was helpful. And I'm an educator. If anybody needs questions answered, nobody has to pay me for my time. They don't have to work with my law firm or my agency. I want people to have knowledge. So I'm always available to help people understand the process.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. We appreciate that, Steve. So that brings us to the end of this episode of the Normalized Surrogacy Podcast by Surrogacy Mentor. I'm your host, Carrie Flamer Powell. I want to thank again our very special guest, Steve Snyder, for joining us for this chat today. Be sure to check us out online at surrogacymentor.com if you are interested in knowing whether surrogacy is right for you. Take our easy 2-minute quiz on our website. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast to learn more about gestational surrogacy and how to have a safe, ethical, and enjoyable surrogacy journey. Talk to you next time.